Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk
Radio. Now, I'm delighted to say, for the very first time on this show, I think, we're going to speak to Laura Dodsworth. She's an author, she's a photographer, she's a journalist, she's written many books. She's written a new book called A State of Fear, because I think one of the things we're all slightly puzzled by, those of us who are not living in a state of fear, why so many people actually are. And what is the government doing making people live in a state of fear? I mean, why would they want to do that? Let's talk to Laura right now. Laura, very good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
No, thank you so much for joining us. It's long overdue, I think, the fact that you and I are having a conversation. Tell us a bit about the book, first of all, A State of Fear. What made you write it? What made you decide to write it? And what conclusions have you drawn from it?
Well, I think, like the whole nation, I was just flung backwards into my armchair with a whiplash of shock and fear when Boris Johnson addressed the nation on the 23rd of March, when he told us we must stay at home. It was a really astonishing speech. It used a lot of warlike language, a lot of martial language. And I'd done quite a lot of research. You know, this is what I do. I love researching and investigating. And I had a different sense of the scale of the threat to that point. And the government had performed quite a U-turn in its approach to the virus. So that night scared me. It scared me for lots of reasons. I was worried about the epidemic, like a lot of people were, but I was very worried about authoritarianism and the measures we were taking. I mean, we'd never done this before. We'd never locked down before. We'd never said healthy people have to stay at home and can't go out to work. And I was worried about what the effect would be on society and the economy and on people's health, everything really. But his speech really got me thinking. I thought, why is he trying to create so much alarm? I think there was a lot of fear in the air that night. You caught it one way or the other. It was released like an airborne virus. You know, it was scary. It was really scary. I think people remember that. It's like watching the Queen's speech on Christmas Day, but not happy. You know, we'll all remember where we were when that happened. And I thought that the big story really of the last year is, how did everyone become so frightened? The investigation has taken me on a really fascinating and sometimes quite disturbing journey. What I've uncovered is how deeply embedded behavioural psychology is in governments. So they use this technique called nudge. Now, a nudge is not a mandate. It's a behavioural psychology technique to get you to do what they want you to do, to change your behaviour.
Yeah.
Behaviour is not about feelings. It doesn't care about how you feel, but it will use your feelings to change your behaviour, to make you the model citizen. There are lots of ways this is being employed in quite innocuous ways, like making you pay your taxes on time, or making smoking less desirable, trying to encourage us to lose weight, to lock up the biscuit tins. But what they've done this time is lock us up. And my book sets out the argument that the use of fear is ethically dubious. What I do is take you through how this happens, how governments use fear, how our government has used fear, who is behind it, the behavioural psychologists, Spybee, they're the advisors that feed into Sage and government, the tactics they used and the impacts it's had. And I've also interviewed people who've been quite undone by fear this year, because we can't talk about the life that might be saved potentially from a lockdown if we don't talk about the life lost when somebody jumped from a bridge or didn't get treatment because they were too scared to leave their house and go to hospital.
Yeah, listen, and I mean, I've spoken to people on this show who have called in. I remember one woman from last week who's now currently suffering from stage 4 cancer, who would not be suffering from stage 4 cancer had she seen a doctor a year ago when she was only suffering from stage 1 cancer. And you're absolutely right. I mean, I asked this. I'm so happy that you've picked up on this, because I asked this question a long time ago through the pandemic, when we discovered who Sage were and who was actually part of Sage and what they were all about. And I said, I'm sure this means that we've been the victims of all of this for a very long time, that they've been using these characters to change government policy, to change public policy, to change public behaviour all over the place.
You're so right. Now, I keep an eye on the job ads, and they don't stop recruiting behavioural scientists. This is really big business. Unfortunately, the business of fear is big business now for the government. And it really disturbs me, because I don't think this is the way to work towards what we imagine society should look like. You know, in a democracy, you don't try and persuade people subtly beneath the level of their consciousness. You give them the facts and you let them make up their mind about what they want to do. Or you have laws and mandates. you know, then at least people know what they're up against. The thing about this very heavy use of behavioral psychology we have is that people are being subliminally manipulated without knowing. What it does is strip choice away. But the use of fear is particularly disturbing. Now, if a psychologist wanted to scare you in a lab, you would have to sign a consent form. You'd have to agree to the process and you would leave the lab very happy. You know, they'd make you watch a happy film and give you a slice of chocolate cake. You know, we're not getting happy films and chocolate cake. What we're getting is more nudge. Mm. It just hasn't stopped. You know, I was nodding along as you introduced the show, because here we are the day after our restrictions are being released. And actually, you know, we're having more scary things dangled over us to keep the level of alarm high. As you said, the so-called Indian variant hasn't actually caused any big problems for us yet, and yet we're being told that might be why restrictions can't be released on the 21st of June.
But this is their favourite word, isn't it? Their favourite word is could, might. You never hear them actually saying anything specifically, this will happen. They never use that terminology.
I think that's a really good point. And actually, that's quite tortuous for people, because people need certainty and they need deadlines. This is a little bit like Christmas. Do you remember? It was on, it was off, it was on, it was off. And that really caused a lot of distress and stress for people. It's this huge celebration. It's one of the most important days in our calendar. We didn't know what was happening. Yeah. And now everyone's had the 21st of June to look forward to. We were told we could cry freedom by Easter. And now we're being told it might be retracted. But I think there's something that's behind this. And you see, it is the nudging. Mm. Look at the language around the vaccine. We're being told that vaccine refuseniks will hold up the easing of restrictions. But this is quite a dangerous path to go down. You know, othering people and dehumanizing people and using critical language to scapegoat them just creates a blame game among people and a lot of ill will. Yeah. And it creates fear. You know, which team do you want to be in? Do you want to be in the nasty team that's keeping everybody in lockdown? Or do you want to be on the good heroic team that's had the jab?
Right.
I don't think it's a very nice way to encourage people to have a medical intervention. You know, tell people how effective it is, make it available. Don't tell people that they're holding up lockdown for everyone else. It's a tactic of fear again.
Yeah. It's a demonising. It's a demonising tactic in the same way that Neil O'Brien, the Tory MP who's now sitting happily in the cabinet, apparently responsible for the levelling up of the country, decided to start compiling a list of journalists that he thought might be refuseniks in some way, people who might be dissidents. You know, the sort of thing that the former Soviet Union would have done, the former, you know, Gulag merchants would have done, to say, off you go, get re-educated. We don't want you talking like this because you're upsetting people. I mean, I find it quite extraordinary.
Yeah, the use of the word refusenik is interesting. This is no accident. It's supposed to take us back to Reds Under the Bed. It's like, who wants to be one of those commie vaccine deniers? You know, it's crazy language. And it's just not fair play. It's not treating us like adults in a mature relationship with our government. I think that list of journalists was really disturbing. Mm. You know, I was really disappointed that a member of the British government in 2020 made a list of journalists. Mm. And not just journalists, but scientists.
Scientists too, yeah.
Highly, highly credible, respected scientists. Mm. Because they went against the government narrative. If you're going to list the mistakes you believe people have made, but you only list one set of mistakes that go against the government narrative, that's propaganda.
Yeah. It really is. And there's no question that that's what they've been engaged in. And they've even admitted it. And people still don't get it. You know, even Whitty and Vallance stood up, I think it was back in November, and actually admitted at one of their briefings that they had refused to show one part of the graph because it wouldn't have actually compared as badly as they wanted it to what was going on in the previous summer. They also admitted that sometimes they overestimated the numbers of deaths in order to frighten people into behaving properly. But yet, people are still frightened into behaving properly.
Yeah, I think that by now there's a really high level of suspicion towards these tactics. Ultimately, that's quite damaging for our trust in the government and also trust in public health. So this is where it gets dangerous. You know, I want to trust my government has my best interests at heart and will tell me the truth. And I certainly want to extend that trust to everybody who's advising on public health. But if you feel like you're being misled or your fears are being exaggerated, that doesn't lead to a trusting relationship between government and citizen. I mean, that particular shock and awe presentation that you refer to by Whitty and Vallance, that was called out. Mm. I think Theresa May said in Parliament that they were taking the statistics to suit the policy, not the policy to suit the statistics. Right. And the National Statistics Authority also very rarely made a comment about the use of statistics during the epidemic as well. It's not right to cherry pick the data, but unfortunately that's happened all year.
Yeah, that's exactly what they've done. Which brings us, I suppose, Laura, to the $64,000 question. Why are they doing this? Because it doesn't appear to be beneficial to the economy. It's certainly not beneficial to the nation's health overall. So I can't ever quite get an answer to that. I don't believe that they're somehow in league with the World Economic Forum and they're trying to contain us all into some bizarre new world where nobody owns anything and everybody's renting a flat. I don't think it's that. I don't think it's because they're completely and utterly enthralled with leading everybody down the path like some kind of Pied Piper of Hamelin. I just think it's partly because they don't know what else to do and they haven't learned how to say no to these sage advisors.
It's really hard to call that one out. And I have to be honest, I don't in my book. My book is about how the UK government weaponized fear. And it's less about why. I think what's important is that people understand what sort of manipulation has occurred. Mm. The book in itself is like an anti-nudge guidebook. Right. Once you know these techniques, you are kind of protected from them. So I think that's important. And it makes a clarion call for a public inquiry into the use of behavioural psychology and specifically the weaponisation of fear, not just in this epidemic, but historically. There have been calls before for a public consultation on this, and we've not yet had it. We really need it. I think the why is hard. Look, while a house is burning, you don't necessarily know what's caused the fire. You have to wait till the ashes are cooled. And all of those whys really belong in a public inquiry, which I sincerely hope will be robust and honest and independent. I can't say why they do it, but it's a story as old as time. Governments have leaned on fear to engender the results they want forever. Mm. And unfortunately, the tools now at their disposal are that much more sophisticated. Behavioural psychology is very sophisticated. Data analytics, the use of social media. It's all too easy. And we need to be aware of the tools. The why, I can't answer for you.
Well, can we make people more robust then? Because fortunately for me, I'm not quite sure why, but I've always suffered from defiance syndrome, so whereby anybody telling me something to do, I immediately want to do something completely different and probably to the opposite extreme. So I've instilled that in most of my kids as well, and a lot of people like me are the same, and we're now a sort of two-tier society. The people who say, just no, thank you very much, we're not having any of that. You know, I was saying yesterday to Peter Hitchens, I walked through London Bridge Station, and it's unbelievable how many signs there are, you know, which go everything from, you know, stay to the right, to wear a face covering, to, you know, wash your hands, to be kind, to, you know, the train's this way, you know, it's just incredible. We've sort of suddenly become this society where people have become so used to being told what to do that if nobody tells them what to do, they don't know what to do.
Yeah, but you have to remember during this, very cleverly, that was dressed up as being social responsibility, yeah, being a hero, being good, protecting others. So what they did was make people afraid. Fear of death is a very powerful, powerful thing. And then around that led up with social responsibility and moral virtuousness. So everything you did was to protect others, but at the same time, it was really to protect yourself. Mm. It's a very powerful tool. But we are all different, and I think we should all also welcome that. The problem is that people who can be more sceptical, like you, and I'm going to call your defiance syndrome intelligence and scepticism, because I think that's what it is, really.
So, yeah.
And me, you know, we're also important members of society. You know, the outliers, the people who think out the box, we're all needed. You know, we all make up one society and we should welcome different ways of thinking, not trying to scapegoat people that don't seem to fit into the narrative. So some people are very comfortable with clear guidance and clear rules, and others aren't. I think there's a difference there between guidance and mandates. And there's also a difference between guidance and sneaky nudges when we can't see what they are. And we just need to be more transparent about all of it. Yes, people can become more robust to behavioural psychology, 100%. I would argue, of course I would, that reading the book is a good start, because you'll understand more about what's happened in the last year. Also, people become increasingly emotional the longer they watch bad news and watch social media. Take breaks, come back from it. And also research a bit more widely, look at different viewpoints, and maintain an open mind.
I was going to say, I think part of the reason why people have kind of bought it quite so much as they have is that they've looked around into Europe. They've looked around the world. They've also seen other countries' governments doing the same kinds of things. And so it doesn't appear abnormal. I think if Britain had been the only country doing it, it might have been slightly more resistant, you know, whereas because people were looking at Italy at the time, I remember those terrible pieces of footage of India, of Italy in March of last year, where they were sort of taking corpses out of hospitals. They were piling them high inside the hospitals. They were driving, you know, lorries full of dead people around in the middle of the night. Ooh. And that was quite a frightening vision for, I think, a lot of politicians, not least the population, you know.
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting example. And I talk about that in the book. That particular footage was not because they were overrun with bodies. No, it's because at that particular point in time, lots of funeral directors were in isolation. So they called in the army for a one-off moving of bodies.
Right.
But instead of that being very accurately verified by the initial picture desk at an agency, it's blasted out all over the world. And the impression it would have given you is that Italy is overrun with dead bodies.
Right.
It's a one-off example.
Mm. They're still doing it.
The media, in isolation.
Yeah, I mean, I call them media manipulators because that's what they are. And I'm sorry to say that there are many of my, you know, colleagues in this very business that we are in. They're doing the same thing in India. We spoke to an Indian chef yesterday, Cyrus Toniwala, who has family in India. And he says, you know, it's nothing like the way it's being portrayed. You know, yes, there are hot spots and yes, there are people dying, but it's nothing like as bad as the way that it's being made to look by the BBC and by Sky.
It's really difficult. I mean, something that I found quite a bitter pill to swallow last year was that I lost trust in some of my former trusted sources. That was a shock to me. Mm. It was a bit of an epiphany. There is a whole chapter dedicated to the media in the book to explain why these things happen. Because also journalists are people, you know, they're subject to the same fears. They can be really busy. You can have slightly too close relationships between politicians or political journalists. It's a complicated situation. But the media has definitely engaged in a lot of the doom mongering. Mm. I mean, in the last year, we've been told to be scared of everything from ice cream to semen. You know, COVID was everywhere.
Yeah.
It was 24/7 fear mongering, but sadly, never without the context, of what people die of from, you know, like the figures in India now, they do sound alarming. And I don't want to refute that there's a virus in India and that people are dying from it. But we have never looked at other infectious diseases or any other causes of death in India with the same lens.
Well, funnily enough,
and if you put it into context, it would be, you know, if we did this all the time, we'd be permanently anxious about death and disease. And this isn't actually a very nice way to live.
It's
I think we'll all be glad when it's behind us.
No, I mean, lots of people are alarmed at the fact that between 3,000 and 4,000 people a day are dying in India from COVID. Well, guess what? 27,000 die every day from all sorts of reasons, because it's got a very big population. It's got a very low health ratio to human sort of, you know, potential living standards, and quite simply, it's a very poor country in many places, and so there's an awful lot of people who die for all sorts of reasons. So, you know, it's very easy to take everything out of context. But Laura, listen, we're out of time, sadly. Great to talk to you. The book is called A State of Fear, available, I assume, from all good bookshops now that you can go in one.
Yes, available everywhere. I'd really recommend people look at their independent or companies like Blackwell's, Waterston's, Foyles. It's quite hard to find on Amazon. There's something a bit strange going on where if you search for it, it doesn't come up.
Really?
But you can find it in the bestseller list. Yay. And you can also follow what my pinned tweet. But do look at your independent or Hive or Wordery. It's great for international as well.
Okay, brilliant stuff. Lauren Dodsworth, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. Journalist, photographer, author of A State of Fear.